Well, I think part of the sourcing process to me is the most exciting, because you know, you rent a car and you drive through the south of France, and you know, you obviously have some appointments set up, but you know, some of the most exciting things happen when you're just kind of winging it. And you meet a farmer at, you know, a wine fair, and he's, you know, he says, "Well, come back to my estate," and you're not quite sure where you're going, and you follow a guy in a Peugeot, you know, up a rambling hill, and all of a sudden you come across either a castle or like a shack in the woods, and the guy's making wine out of the back of his, you know, house, or he could be making wine out of a major estate. You know, looks are deceiving, but you want to assume that someone with a very established chateau is making good wine. But 9 times out of 10, the guy out of the garage who's like super passionate is making these better wines, and they're maybe more rustic and less polished. So to me, like the restaurateur, the sommelier, this story resonates with them about the small farmer, you know, the guy who's making wine on small quantities, 80 cases, 100 cases. Those are the things exciting to Barterhouse, and hopefully the things exciting to our clients.
Thank you for listening this afternoon on At the Root of It on the Heritage Radio Network, heritageradionetwork.com. I'm your host, Aaron Fitzpatrick, and it is Tuesday, the 26th of October. And we'll roll in today's show with the Week in Wine recap and in latest news and distressing news reported today on Decanter.com that up to 1/3 of Muscadet's wine growers are facing financial ruin due to a meltdown in export markets and unsustainable pricing levels. According to Loire Valley wine broker Charles Sidney, around 60 Muscadet vignerons have filed bankruptcy since this year's harvest. A total of 150 to 200 vignerons are expected to go out of business in the next few months. Growers have been hit by a number of factors, one being the after effects of 2008's devastating spring frost, which destroyed up to 2/3 of the crop. Now many vineyards are being abandoned and neglected. And in the crop report last week, I reported on the wet harvest season in Sonoma. This week, we head to Napa for a check-in on the crop there. And after a long, rainy winter and spring bud break, got off to a late start. It was followed by one of the coolest summers in the last 60 years. During the unusually cool summer, foggy morning created conditions favorable for mildew. And growers thinned and opened vine canopies and dropped fruit at Verizon to speed maturation of the remaining clusters. Short heat waves in late August and again in late September caused some sunburn to the remaining exposed fruit, and there are some reports that some high-altitude mountain Cabernet in Napa has yet to fully mature, with two rain systems imminent in the next week. The good news is that the mild growing season, the flavors have developed in hand with sugars, so not a long hang time year. And lastly, in the market feed, LVMH has acquired 17.1% of Hermès International, paying less than half the market price for the shares due to the use of derivatives, fueling speculation that LVMH will fund a full takeover of the brand through the sale of its 66% stake in Moët Hennessy to Diageo. LVMH has insisted it is not seeking control, while some investors are questioning whether this purchase will encourage further consolidation in the luxury goods sector. We're going to take a short break, but before I break, thank you to our sponsor, Barterhouse, who you heard Brian DeMarco before the beginning of this program, and to our producer this afternoon, Jack Inslee, and engineer, Nat Wiener. So we'll be right back after the break with my guest, Jamie Gordon, who is the brand specialist for Pernod Ricard USA. You are listening to At the Root of It on the Heritage Radio Network.com, and thanks for joining us today. For any listeners, please call in with questions at 718-497-2128. We'll be speaking Pernod today and pastis and absinthe with my guest this afternoon, Jamie Gordon. Welcome.
Hey, it's good to be here.
So Jamie was just telling me before the show, he scored a coveted seat at the restaurant El Bui and just didn't return too long ago, yeah?
Yeah, and God, it's the time flies, I suppose, in New York, but about a month ago, it was a little month and a half. God, it does fly.
Yeah. Yeah. How was it?
August 31st. It was phenomenal.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it really kind of redefines your eating experience. I mean, you get used to sort of, to a certain extent, I suppose. I mean, you can, if you're me and kind of a jerk, get used to fine dining and, you know, just because of the industry that we're in.
Sure.
You end
yeah.
up places. But, it really kind of subverts that. I mean, you're eating with your hands most of the time, which is a blast. You feel like a little kid. And everything is, I mean, almost part of the procedure is being surprised at what's put in front of you and kind of laughing and you know, it each dish is a little thrill. So it's cool.
Nice. And how many courses is it again?
We had 30.
30.
Yeah.
Damn.
And it's cool because you're not really given the option. You just kind of sit down and they start putting food in front of you. And at a certain time, about 3 hours later, they're like, do you want us to keep going? Because we can, or we can
oh,
stop.
Oh, really? You have an option?
Yeah.
Okay.
And the amazing thing, I mean, I don't know what sort of like incredible math is involved, but you finish sort of perfectly content. You're not too full.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want any more to eat. I don't know how many calories they were, but it was,
sure.
you know, not one over what
amazing.
Is like exactly the desired.
And you were quality. At a table of eight, so did everyone kind of feel the same way?
Yeah, and I mean, again, it's maybe a little bit of a spoiled viewpoint, but I almost think that's kind of the way to do it, is if you can sit with a bunch of people, because it is so fun. Everybody's just, you know, you laugh at almost every plate that comes out.
Yeah.
So it's, yeah, it's just a really, it was a wonderful experience.
Nice.
Yeah.
So today you brought for us two of the brands from your portfolio. And
yes.
for listeners just joining, Jamie is the brand specialist for Absolut and Absinthe Pernod.
Plymouth Gin, Beefeater Gin.
Yep. You got a whole...
yeah. Any range of occasions I can accommodate.
But we haven't spoken about Pernod Pastis on the program before, so I wanted to kind of hone in on that today. So what have you brought for us?
Well, I did bring the Pastis Pernod and also the Absinthe Pernod. And one of the sort of cool things, I suppose, when I first sort of started working on Pernod, I did a bunch of research on absinthe, et cetera, et cetera. And one of the, I think, the coolest thing probably about Pernod is that it invented absinthe.
Mm-hmm.
It's where the entire category comes from. And the company that I work for, which is called Pernod Ricard, you know, obviously wears the name on the first half of its title. So it's where, you know, it's sort of the origin of a lot of things.
So the creator of absinthe.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, in 1805, a tiny little town, Henri-Louis Pernod.
Pernod. Yeah, let's hear that a little bit about the history before we get into its current place in the market.
Yeah, no, it was like a lot of other things. It was developed as for its medicinal properties. It's got wormwood, which is Artemisia absinthium, is the sort of the Latin for it. And Artemis is obviously the Greek goddess of the moon and protector of women. So it's a chick drink at its heart. but
otherwise known as the Green Fairy.
The
right?
Green Fairy,
yeah.
Yes. what is it? Le Fay Vert, something like that.
Yep.
The way that it really kind of caught on is a fellow called Major Dubied purchased it from a doctor who used to administer it. And I only bring the doctor up because it's one of the best names ever. It's Pierre Ordinaire, which. I would not go to a doctor called Ordinary Peter.
Right.
But people did.
And he was Swiss, if I'm not misunderstood, right?
He was, yep. And actually, it started out made in Switzerland, right near the French border. And eventually, Henri-Louis Pernod, who Major Dubied hired, because Major Dubied sold lace. Another very French.
Yeah.
Item, but they were making it, and it caught on really in France, not in Switzerland so much. And so they were paying, you know, sort of border taxes to mm-hmm. import it. And so he eventually built the distillery on the French side in Pontellier, mm-hmm. Or Pontellier, I suppose, to avoid that tax and also to cut down on the commute a little bit. So, you know, but the way that it got or it gained popularity is it's kind of a time-honored tradition of giving it to soldiers. Excuse me. They actually took it to Northern Africa and drank it for medicinal purposes still. It was an anti-malarial or certain properties of wormwood are. And,
uh-huh.
Absinthe is primarily flavored with fennel, star anise, and wormwood, grand wormwood. And so, you know, they sort of developed a taste for it there, brought it, or when they came back home, they would drink it, you know, at the cafes and whatever, and the aristocracy really sort of became enamored with the appearance of these guys drinking this green drink and started doing it themselves. And that eventually caught on to the point where the period between 5 and 7 in the evening, happy hour here, was referred to as the green hour in France.
Oh, wow.
For quite a while. Yeah, which is just sort of and suppose you could walk down sort of the Grand Boulevards in Paris and just smell
and yeah. Everyone being a little bit loosey.
Yeah, well, and you know, the whole sort of custom of the absinthe fountain is a very social one where you sort of sit around and wait for your drink to make itself. It's a slow dilution process. You drip it over a sugar cube, and it's a very social custom.
Cool.
They call it the ritual.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to stop you right there in the midst of that history, because we do have a caller on the line. Call, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Hi.
How are you?
Well,
how's it going? My name is Martin Smith Matson.
Martin. Hey.
What's up, Jamie? I got your text, and I heard you're speaking on the radio, so that's pretty cool.
Yeah, no, they let me out of the basement for a couple hours, and I get this.
He's pretty pale, isn't he? He's pretty pale.
A little bit, yeah. He's
I didn't get a shave either. It's, you know, I shouldn't be here, puffy-eyed and all.
So, Martin, are you creating some cocktails at the moment you'd like to share with us?
Yeah, I am. I have the delight to present a brand new Pernod Absinthe cocktail here at Double Crown.
Oh, nice.
Located on Bleecker and Bowery. It's just featured on the brunch menu. And I think it would make Hemingway proud. Hemingway is known for enjoying absinthe quite a bit.
Death in the afternoon, isn't it?
Exactly, yeah.
Exactly.
And I think his recipe
specified... And also drinking at all hours of the day, so...
Yeah, well, his recipe specified drink 4 or 5. That was part and parcel.
Yeah, I like that you're rolling that out with the brunch menu.
So I just made a little tipple here. It's served in a champagne flute. It's called the Bottle Rocket. And it's sort of a seasonal cocktail for the winter, nice in the morning. It's a blend of white cranberry, Pernod absinthe, sparkling wine, and maple grenadine that's homemade.
Huh.
Wow.
And then topped off a little bit of pineapple juice. So
right on.
Visually stunning cocktail, delicious in the morning. You know, get your sleepy eyes open. And really a delight to be able to sort of add on to the history of wonderful absinthe morning cocktails. So.
Yeah, well, and now you're world famous because you've been on the radio.
When are you rolling out with that? Is that this weekend?
That actually, we just started that this weekend, so this was the first brunch feature, and now it'll be rolling out for the next, you know, months until the seasons change. But I think it's a nice morning brunch cocktail to sort of enjoy.
Yeah, it sounds delightful, and I'm sure on Halloween you'll have plenty of takers for that. We'll enjoy it all afternoon.
For sure.
Well, thanks for your call, Martin.
Well, listen, my pleasure, always.
Cheers, man. See you
Take
soon.
Take care, Jamie. I'll talk to you soon.
Not Bye. That I've ever met you before.
All right. Well, what do you think of that? That sounded pretty interesting.
Well, it's sort of a quick shout-out for Martin. His drinks are awesome.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of no exception. So
nice.
Yeah.
You know? So that's a Double Crown, which is on the Bowery in Bleecker.
That's right.
And they have a Madame Geneva just next door, yep. Which...
A little gin bar.
Yep. So he's doing the list for both of those places, yeah. I imagine. Yeah.
He has such a nice radio voice in these headphones. I'm going to take them off again in a minute now that Martin's gone.
So then, okay, we're cruising down the streets in Paris. It's green hour.
It's green hour. Yeah, well, and you know, it's sort of at about this sort of time in history. This is probably 1850s to 1870s, something like this. That you know, it really sort of starts to build a lot of momentum, and manages to grab the attention of a lot of the sort of noted artists of the day. So it's, you know, another really interesting thing about working on Pernod in particular, and another brand that I work on, Absolute, has done a lot of work with artists as well. But being an art geek, I really get sort of a little bit more of an excuse to look into it, to talk about it, to research it, what have you. But yeah, it's kind of cool that it's the Pernod bottle in all the paintings by, or, you know, not all of the paintings, obviously, but, you know, it's appeared in, you know, Picasso's and Duchamp's and Toulouse-Lautrec's, and really sort of as I think as much sort of the green fairy apparition captured the imagination of a lot of the artists of the day. And as a result is really kind of a noted presence, mm-hmm, in a certain period of, you know, art.
Sure, yeah.
Almost across the board.
And then what are the other botanicals are in there that make it such a unique blend?
Well, it's sort of, it's Grand and Petite Wormwood. There's usually a little bit of hyssop, some melissa, coriander actually frequently sort of plays a role.
Mint?
Mint can.
Yeah.
There is not actually mint in Pernod.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I won't use that accent again.
please do.
But yeah, it's for the most part, I mean, Pernod now is actually a blend of distillates, which is kind of an interesting way of building a spirit. But the sort of primary players in there are Grand and Petit Wormwood, and Petit Wormwood is actually the more fragrant of the two, star anise and fennel, and there's, I believe, a little bit of a coriander distillate in there as well.
Nice.
Yeah, so it's I think it's, you know, a lot of people sort of talk about sort of the ritual of lighting absinthe on fire, and that's really more of a Bohemian or Czech style thing. I mean, the lovely thing about French and Swiss absinthe is that you don't need to. I mean, my personal opinion is that you light the stuff on fire to burn off some of the harsh alcohol anyway.
But this is pretty smooth. And
yeah, it's a lovely sort of floral. And actually, since we have some here.
Yes, let's take a look at that.
Yeah.
So we have, as Jamie mentioned, just Pernod, which, and then the Pernod Absinthe. So,
and you've poured both, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep, side by side. And looking at how the colors change from a very green chartreuse with the addition of water.
Yeah, it's called louching, mm-hmm. Which literally, you know, translates to opaque in the French. So it's the oils in the spirit actually react with water.
So what are the essential differences then between these two?
Well, for starters, alcohol level.
Yeah.
Pernod Pastis is 40 ABV, so 80 proof. ABV is alcohol by volume. And then Pernod Absinthe's original strength and current strength is 68%. So that's, what, 132 proof, mm-hmm. something like that. My math skills are the reason that I'm in the spirits industry.
Ditto.
The whole sort of pastis category, well, not, I can't say it came about because of, but grew in popularity considerably, especially the French pastis category, because of the whole absinthe left when it was banned.
Mm-hmm.
And along with a lot of other spirits that have gone through sort of, long histories or troubled histories, there was a period in absinthe history where it was... people were routinely over-serving themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a lot of people, because there was such a demand for it, a lot of people were making it cheaply. Sort of like the gin craze in England, where people were flavoring gin with turpentine and things along those lines. It became poisonous. And that's really where, and with the, by and large, you know, it's 68% is pretty extreme. And that's why you dilute it with water. Usually, it's like 6 or 7 to 1 usually. I actually think 5-1 is pretty good as well. But you know, I'm I'll end that.
You're a little bit more primed,
right?
Yeah.
But the other sort of main differentiation I think you'll find is that in Pernod Pastis, there's no actual wormwood.
Exactly, yeah. That needs to be specified.
And
yeah.
that there's a chemical called thujone that occurs in wormwood that people for a while thought was related to THC, which is the you know, hallucinogen in marijuana. And in the end, it's just sort of bad math or bad science, you know. So. Mm-hmm. About 100 years down the line, they worked out that they were wrong, and that's how absinthe has come back on the market after a prolonged absence.
Absence, yes.
Sorry.
Well, as far as color, you could see that the Pernod Pastis is a bit denser, but given that the more or less the same amount were in the
I've
glass.
I've actually never tasted them side by side like this.
Yeah. So for those who have not had Pernod, you get this, you know, that anise, that licorice.
I mean, the Pernod is just a much richer, certainly more floral and vegetal a little bit, but in a, I think, really pleasant way, flavor profile.
Definitely. And I think I agree with you on the 5-1. It could use a little extra,
yeah,
you know?
Right?
Yeah. and then how have you seen just with the re-entry of absinthe into the U.S. market in the past couple of years, just the surge in that?
Yeah, well, it came, you know, fast out of the gate in part because of sort of the buzz that has always sort of surrounded absinthe. That, oh, you know, it's you go crazy or you cut off your ear or, you know, you hallucinate. Yeah. And really, my personal opinion is that none of the above are necessarily true. But so there was, you know, I think it popped out very quickly because there had been a long-standing interest in it, and now sort of when I talk about it publicly, people are like, you know, what is absinthe? Where does it come from? What's the deal? And so that curiosity sort of has sustained itself, but it's you know, just by virtue of it not being quite so new, I think that things have slowed down a little bit. But it's a really unique very distinctive way to, that's kind of redundant, I was trying to find a word that wouldn't be, but distinctive way to sort of change the profile of your cocktail mix, you know? So whether it's gin or, you know, there's the Sazerac famously uses an absinthe wash in the glass. So it works with, you know, rye or you know, cognac before that in the Sazerac. It works with a lot of spirits. It's a very flexible mixer, and as such, I think it's got, you know, considerable staying power on the cocktail scene, both because of its history and because of its, you know, sort of wide range of applications. And
definitely,
you know,
I feel like you can use it very subtly, like you said, as a rinse or a wash of the glass, and it have that characters and those aromatics give off, but not necessarily, you know, directly follow through on the palate. So you have a little more of an indirect.
It's great that Martim called in because it's such an unconventional absinthe cocktail as compared to, say, you know, a Sazerac or a Death in the Afternoon, which is just champagne and, you know, absinthe. So
yeah, a lot that you can do.
Yeah. It's a fun thing to play around with. And, you know, certainly I think the sort of tradition of absinthe drinking and its history sort of in the artist communities, makes it a little bit more compelling as well.
Yeah, I mean, when you think about the other things in the family of anacid, like Greek ouzo and the Turkish raki, I mean, this has, I don't know the history of those spirits as much as, you know.
Well, you know, I think a lot of people's probably first experience with anise spirits is probably Sambuca, where you do like Sambuca or what have you. And I was sort of saying to you earlier today that one of the interesting things to me is that of all the sort of, you know, wide and varied drinking cultures out there, there's an anise flavored spirit in almost all of them, and America does not have one, which I find interesting. And I wonder if it's because we have fewer sort of, you know, you don't see licorice occurring naturally or, you know, growing natively in many forests here, so it hasn't come into use that way, or just as a sort of collective palate. We don't dig.
Yeah.
Anise. So, it's
well, there's also like fennel and people maybe probably. I wouldn't be surprised if there's someone that's going to come out with their DIY kind of the version of it. And then it's also used in cooking. I mean, it has some classic dishes that are associated with it.
Oysters Rockefeller, I suppose, is the most prominent in my mind. Mm-hmm. But that's because it's oyster season now, and I love oysters. So
definitely. And what is it? Any season that ends with an ER?
Yes, something like that. And it's fall, so I don't know how that works. But somebody told me it was oyster season, so it must be.
September, October, November. I don't think everyone follows that, nor do I know. It's but there's a lot of awesome.
There's a lot of awesomeness, essentially. I concur heartily. You mentioned mussels earlier. It seems to pair pretty well with seafood or things that come in shells.
Yeah. Lobster, shrimp, mussels with a little touch of cream.
Yeah.
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 And you said earlier that as well, I mean, that seems like a very kind of Marseille or Southern France kind of dish. What are the roots to that?
It
originated in Marseille. You had mentioned the...
Marseille is where Pernod is made now.
Yeah.
But I think that as much as anything, the fact that Pernod is used in a lot of seafood dishes has to do with the fact that, France has a certain proximity to the sea, which is, where it obviously came into heavy use. And so there were lots of shellfish and lots of absinthe.
Yeah.
It lends itself to, on a sort of savory note, maybe lighter flavors. I don't think it would do quite as well with a steak frite.
No, so. Not so much. The aromatics of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They'd be, conflicting.
Sure. And you had mentioned that this year going forward, I know just in general your company having a really strong year, and you're going to be looking at ways to further kind of collaborate with the art scene and Pernod. And can you speak a little bit about that?
Yeah, actually, I believe last year was the first year we did it, but every year Pernod sponsors an artist's sort of, I guess you call it a competition, but it's, I always hesitate to sort of,
put it in that context.
Yeah. Art into, into the context of competition. But, yearly we have, we sponsor or sort of a contest again, but where artists sort of contribute or submit art, based around sort of the Pernod or the idea of Pernod or the bottle, or really it's sort of open to interpretation. And the winners receive $1,805.
Nice.
Which, yes. Yep. Doesn't suck. Just sort of commemorating the year of Pernod's inception. It's trying to sort of just uphold the tradition of Pernod's place in the art world and, pushing things forward, giving people an excuse to keep on kind of creating.
Cool. And is there any website to your company to check out further information? Or
sure. Yeah. I mean, we're at PernodRicard.com, and you can link to all the brands if you have any interest, but Pernod Absinthe as well is out there.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, thanks so much. This has been hugely educational and fun as well. So nice
Not
to have
at all.
You.
No, it's been a pleasure.
And thank you again to our sponsor, The Barter House, proud to support the Heritage Radio Network and the community of food and beverage lovers. And to our producer today, Jack Inslee, and engineer Nat Wiener. So look forward to seeing you next week, and thanks for joining. Pensando que eras mía, pero aquel antifaz que...